Okay. Questions from what we spoke about? Yeah.
So if men and women are unequal and should have different, not equal but with different roles, what about women who want to have, or have like feel the exceptions who feel they should have men's roles?
So it depends. There are certain aspects of a men's role that are legally forbidden to a woman, and there are certain aspects which are preferential for men as against women. That will depend upon the particular item that she feels that she wants to do. And that will have to be answered on a case-by-case basis. But it's a little bit like if I come to the temple with my animal because of my rejoicing or my sin or my obligation, and the Kohanim meet me at the door and they say, "How nice of you to bring your sacrifice. Hand it over. Goodbye. Go home. It's my sacrifice. It's my dedication. It's my attachment to God. Too bad. You know, I'm not a Kohen, so it's not my role. And if I do it, it's an abomination."
Okay, on a practical level, what about a woman who, say, wants to drive the tractor, but if she does it, say she contravenes sneas. So what do we do then?
Well, first of all, if she wants to, there's always a way to do it. It won't contravene sneas. You know, I'm reminded of what it was like before air conditioning. Now, judges who sat hearing cases in 1920 in the summer sit in long black robes. I don't think that was very comfortable. And in England, they wear those ridiculous powdered wigs. You can't be a judge without a powdered wig. We just don't have that. It's very uncomfortable. That's true. But the position is worth it. Not everything is decided on bare animal comfort. Presidents, even before air conditioning, didn't go around in t-shirts and shorts. So we recognize that certain dignities, a certain respect, a certain values, are worth putting up with certain kinds of discomforts.
The young lady feels that, there's nothing wrong with my body, and it's hot, there's nothing, I don't really feel like wearing long clothes.
So that's no different from that Jew who will say, "I don't see anything wrong with cheeseburgers." She just doesn't see that this mitzvah applies.
So what do you do in this situation?
You don't do anything, she's opted out of the system. If a person says, "I know it's wrong, and I would like to keep it, I would like to do it right, but I'm just not strong enough to do it," that's something else. But a person says, "This part of the system doesn't appeal to me," that person says, "I'm judging the system. The system's not judging me." That's a person who doesn't really believe in God, who doesn't understand the concept, and has misunderstood the whole system. It's not part of the system at all. Yeah.
From my understanding, one of the husband's roles to woman is to provide for her financially. Yet, a lot of times in the Haredi world, it seems that the husband will perhaps put Torah at a very high priority, and the wife will be necessity for her to work, for them to maintain a livelihood. Isn't that kind of contradicting traditional rules? Doesn't he have the obligation to work? And
it's 100% correct. It's 100% correct. The legal obligation is on him to provide for the family. She has no obligation to do so. But she's not prohibited from working. A woman certainly has the right to go into business, to earn money, to work as a hired laborer. There's no prohibition, but she has no obligation. Now, those two are not the same. And it can be that a woman says, "I want you. I want us to invest in your learning." I'll give you a parallel. A man who wants to become a doctor isn't going to earn a nickel till he's 30. Some of them get married before they're 30. So who carries it? The woman carries it. You say to her, "Look at how he's exploiting you, you know. He's sitting there getting a profession, and you're slaving away to support the tube." What will she say? "I'm investing in our medical future." Only if you start with the assumption that there is a war between the sexes, and that each one is looking for his own private advantage, and that if one gains, the other one has to lose, only if you start with that assumption do you end up with that kind of analysis. If you look at it as a kind of joint project where both are going to benefit from the activities of both, then it doesn't turn out that way. Now, many women in the Haredi world say, "I want a family in which the husband is a scholar. That's what I want. I want that for my family. And therefore, I want to be able to support him to learn as long as it's practical to do so. But bottom line is, when she says, for whatever reason, she can't do it anymore, even if she just decides she doesn't want to do it anymore, it's his responsibility to do it. That's part of that. Yeah. By the way, just to give you a point of comparison, there is a... I know of a case of a famous Hasidic Rebbe. Before he became Rebbe, he was a Rosh Yeshiva, the head of a yeshiva. And his agreement with his wife was, she got up at 9 a.m. He got the children out of bed, he dressed them, made their lunches, gave them breakfast, packed them off to school. She got up at 9 a.m. She took over the house after that. But that was it. They had a passel of kids. That was it. And I have another case in Baltimore where one of the administrators in the yeshiva, his wife decided she wanted to become a nurse. They had, I don't know, 7 or 8 kids. So she left at 3. And he was there from 3 until bedtime. Welcomed the kids home from school and gave them supper and bathed them and told them bedtime stories, put them in the pajamas and put them to sleep. For as many years as it took her in night school to become a nurse. So these things can happen. They're not the typical, but they definitely can happen whenever the circumstances in the family and the couple require. Yeah.
I was wondering, if Judaism is truly non-discriminatory towards men and women, as the world sees it, why is it that we have this image that people tend to associate a sexist view of the religion? Like, what is it that is causing people to think this way?
I will answer you, but I want you to appreciate that this sort of question is sort of it carries dangerous overtones. The question sort of implies that, gosh, if so many people think this way, then there's probably some truth in it. So, you know, we better be able to explain why they think this way, because otherwise, if so many people think so, then probably there's some truth in it. Now, let me just transpose this question into a different subject. Why are there hundreds and hundreds of millions of anti-Semites who are all convinced that Jews are evil? Could so many people be wrong? We better explain why they think that, because, after all, think how many people think it. The fact that a lot of people think something means nothing. It means nothing. The question is, what are their reasons? A million people with no reasons count for zero. One person with 3 reasons counts for 3. Don't ask how many people believe it. Ask what their reasons are. That is a great equalizer. Now, as I indicated, the reason for most people is the New York Times. And the New York Times is full of baloney. You live in Israel, you know how much baloney, right away how much baloney is full of. And when it comes to Jewish issues, it's a bunch of self-hating Jews who can't spell the words right. So that's one thing. And the other thing is what I spoke about. There is this mistake in philosophy that any distinction equals discrimination. And that's simply not true, as I showed you the number of examples that I gave. But I want you to know, Alexis de Tocqueville, the French philosopher, political writer, who visited America in the mid-19th century. And he predicted it. He said, the Americans' passion for equality will demand that everyone be treated identically, because that's the easiest way for simple-minded people to enforce equality, that everybody should be treated the same. And you'll end up with a culture of conformism. He predicted that in the 1850s. And that's sources of it. But even if I couldn't explain it, the facts have to speak for themselves. And if the facts speak for themselves and there's so many people who believe otherwise, you have to ask them for their reasons. And if they can't give reasons, then it's just prejudice. That's what prejudice means. Believing something without reasons. Yeah, what's up? Yeah.
I have 3 questions, if that's okay. First of all, I hope there aren't any feminists in the room, but since women tend to be more emotional, I think, my impression, do we really want them to be making the decisions at the critical times instead of, like, a man that can be like, maybe look at things in more of a perspective rather than just, obviously it's not true all the time, but generally that's like what the impression of the man.
This is a very tricky question. There is some evidence, and I'm convinced of this on my own, that this fellow Damasio, Anthony Damasio, has been writing books on the role of emotion in logic. Emotion is a way of perceiving the world. It can be accurate or inaccurate. It can lead to responses that are appropriate or inappropriate. And it is just as dangerous to lack the appropriate emotion as it is to possess an inappropriate emotion. To be afraid when there's no danger is dysfunctional. And to be confident when there is danger is dysfunctional. In this case, it's probably worse, to be overconfident when there's danger. So possessing more emotion does not necessarily mean the person is going to be having less accurate beliefs or less accurate perceptions. Indeed, possessing less emotion could make the person less accurate in his perceptions and his beliefs. It's rather a question of the mix and how appropriately you can apply the emotions. Now, women will tell you that men possess an emotion which fires them up and works quite constantly and produces great distortions, and that's aggressiveness. Aggressiveness as an attitude and the fight or flight response, which we all love to talk about. Who are you to tell me to do that? Is that going to lead to accurate, reasonable perceptions and responses? Probably not. So I think there's a problem here in defining the issue well and quantifying it and proving that the structure of men's emotions typically is superior in its contribution to accurate decision making than the structure of women's emotions. I think it's not obvious at all.
Okay. Secondly, Chava, though, like, after all, it took like one mistake, it seems like, for the women to start making the right decisions, because really Chava was like the one who convinced them.
I was hoping somebody would say that, but now think of the rule. Meiselman's rule is, in a crisis situation where women and men disagree about what to do, the women are right and the men are wrong. That was the rule. And here, if the women and men agreed, tragically, to do the wrong thing. So this is not an account example to the rule.
And also, aren't there a number of mitzvot that are only for women? Like you were talking about the hierarchy going down from Goy to Eved to Nashim. Aren't there a number of mitzvot that are only for Nashim?
Only mitzvot that by biology could only apply to women. There's a special sacrifice for a woman who gives birth. A man can't give birth. So there, it's clearly not a matter of women over men, it's just that's the way they're made. I don't think anybody's going to talk about...
Is that kind of what we're, like, the point of the Rachel? Like, how we're made differently? Like, it's not just that we're made, like, the stuff we can do. You know what I mean? Like, since a woman can only do something like giving birth and make a bracha, so that should be one of the ones that we count towards, like, that we, like, if we have more...
You don't need any announcement to identify that you are related to that mitzvah. There's no ambiguity. When it comes to putting on tefillin, there's an ambiguity. Well, both men and women can do it, and I've said that I'm a Jew who is an obligated Jew, and I don't know whether that one applies to me. If you know that the person talking is a woman, there's a mitzvah that giving a sacrifice when you give birth. There's nothing to disambiguate there. You don't need an announcement to determine that.
What
that's
about Neirot?
Neirot is not a women's mitzvah. Neirot is a mitzvah for men and women equally, and an unmarried man has to light his own Neirot. Only tradition has given it to the women to do for the household, and the man satisfies his obligation when she does it for him. But when they're in different places, then the man has to worry about his home, and an unmarried man has to worry about his home.
And he should set up the candles. Do we, the Makor?
That's something else. It's a customary that he should set up the candles for her.
Is there like a Makor in Bracha, like when that talks about like what you were saying about like derived how we why that there is that order of Eved?
You know where to look. There's a sefer called Otzar HaTfilos. It's a two-volume edition of the Siddur with four classical commentaries. And right there on the three blessings in the morning, you'll find. Now, this is only in Hebrew, but you can get somebody to read it to you, or if you know Hebrew, then you can see it there. So there's a hand over here. Yeah.
You
want
to say though, like in a critical wartime decision, you're giving to a woman, right? Like, in a circumstance like that, like you think a woman would be right for that?
Gosh, what's her name in England?
Margaret Thatcher.
She went to war with the Falklands, you know? I mean, she made that decision. And I don't know why not. I really don't know why not. Indeed, considering that a man may do it out of spite and pique and honor, I don't know if I want to go to war because he feels the other guy insulted him and he can't take the insult.
Women are sympathetic, though. They're too nice.
Well, the men are too belligerent sometimes. So no one is saying that either sex is perfect. But on balance, we're going to make a judgment. Who's more likely to make the, you know... men have wrought a great deal of destruction on this planet. I could easily hear a lobby saying, give the women a chance. You know, try to find out and see what happens. You know, you certainly haven't done so terrifically well with men running things. We don't have any information that could determine, on the whole, which would be better, which would be worse. Each sex has its weaknesses, and you know, it's hard to know. Yeah.
I just got a weak question. I just trying to know how to interpret it. In the parsha with Noah and his wife, when God tells him to get onto the ark, he tells Noah to get on the ark, followed by his son, followed by his wife and his wife's son, or his son's wife. When they exit the ark, he tells Noah to get off of his wife and his sons to get off of their sons' wife, like at the same time.
Right.
But they don't do that. I was just wondering why.
Okay, it's a little bit of a side issue, but the answer is this. You're right, you're quite right. When they go on, God says, go on the ark, you and your sons, your wife and your sons' wives. Which is very peculiar. No human being would write it that way. It would be insane to write it that way. And it says they do it. And then, as he points out, when they come off, God says, go off the ark, you and your wife, and your sons and your sons' wives. So, oh, that's the normal order. And then it says they went off. Noah and his sons, and his wife and his sons' wives. Back to the old order, the funny order. And the answer is very simple. When he told them to go on to the ark, he told them to go on, men and women separate. The whole world is being destroyed. You can't carry on with life as if nothing was happening. When he told them to go off, he's telling them to get back together to repopulate the world. And they refuse to do it. They refuse to do it. And that's the whole sequence that comes after, which ends in the rainbow. Only after that whole sequence of promising that there won't be another flood and showing them the rainbow, do they agree to do it. That's the whole story there. Okay, yeah.
You said you wanted to speak about legal issues next week, so maybe a question about halakhically, women cannot be witnesses?
Yeah, we'll talk about it next week. Yeah.
I haven't spoken to too many Bahraini younger women, but very often it could come up when I've discussed with Orthodox or conservative younger women, they say that they just don't, that the men seem to have all these extra mitzvahs and shul, they're leaning and they're doing everything and they're putting on tefillin and there's so many things that they have and they're learning Gemara and they don't feel like they say, okay, I'm dressed in this and I'm doing it so soon, they don't feel like they're doing enough, they feel like they're missing something. So is there sort of an explanation?
I think the explanation is this, that I think this is almost tragic, that those who feel most strongly that women have to be given appropriate recognition and appropriate means of expression, they define genuine expression as male expression. Which means that in a certain sense, they are undermining their own dignity. They're undermining their own identity, and they don't even realize it. What they ought to say is, for us to be appropriately valued and appropriately appreciated, we have to have available to us feminine expression, not open the doors to male expression. If you want to open the doors to male expression, you're already defining the male as the standard and the female as deviant. Why do that? Now, let's take a look at the list of feminine and female mitzvahs. First of all, as we will say when we come to the legal aspect, all of Jewish applicable law is something that women are required to study and learn. Well, I can give you 300 fat tomes of extremely complicated and difficult material, laws of interest, requiring legal knowledge and economic knowledge and contract knowledge and mathematics and all the rest. Gosh, there's all the rest. So if she wants to study, there's endless material to study.
But there aren't like call outs to do this.
Why? Because study for her is not a primary, it's not a primary religious obligation. It's a secondary religious obligation. The Midrash says that God said to the Jewish people, I'm going to give you the Torah, but I want a guarantee. Present me something that will be a guarantee. So they offered a variety of options, and God rejected all of them. And finally said, our children. And God said, that's it. You're going to transmit it to your children? That's the guarantee that I want. Now, who is it who lays the foundation of transmitting the Torah to the children? It's the mother. The basic values, the basic attitudes, the basic perceptions, the basic modes of interaction are set by the mother. So she is laying the groundwork by which we possess the Torah. Now, if she appreciates that, then she doesn't need any more than that. If she doesn't appreciate that, then she's not perceiving correctly what's going on. I'll give you an example. I'm trying to express an attitude or an orientation here. Woman says, a homemaker? Being at home with the 2-year-olds and the 3-year-olds all day? That's not stimulating. It's not challenging. It's not fulfilling. It's not rewarding. Thank God we have child care. The Orthodox community, the fruit unity, is full of child care. And the kids can be sent out even before they're 2. Although we regard it as a last resort, but it can be done. It is done, and it's not frowned upon. So what? She wants to be a manager of a boutique. Or she wants to be a lawyer. Or she wants to be a computer programmer. Or a marketing executive or something like that. The most complex entity in the universe is a human being. The most difficult entity to deal with, to develop, is a human being. A computer isn't as complicated as your fingernail. But she says, what are we going to do? Now she says, what are we going to do? Change diapers? Well, if you look at changing diapers, the way you would look at cleaning up the mess of your dog that made on the carpet, that's one thing. But if you look at it as interacting with a developing human being, it's something else. It's a moment, like any interaction with an infant. It's a moment to express an attitude, to reinforce an attitude, to play with the child, to say something to the child, to sing to the child, to caress the child, and build the child's character and self-confidence and security by so doing. So if you define it as a physical activity, then you're not understanding what the activity is. And here's the example that a Rebbetzin in Baltimore made many years ago. She made it to my wife, and I don't remember her name. But she said the following. You look at the woman at the end of the day, she's been changing diapers and sweeping the floor, and she's dirty and messy, and she's disgusted. Now take a coin. A coin is in the temple. What does he look like at the end of the day? Well, what's he been doing? Slaughtering animals and catching the blood in buckets, and then butchering the animals and flaying off the skin and taking out the organs and carrying them up to the altar, putting them on the altar and salting the meat and washing things down. What does he look like at the end of the day? Like an abattoir, like a butcher who's been dealing with meat and blood and guts and entrails and all the rest. Oh, that's true. That's true. He certainly looks messy. But he's been serving in the temple. So it means that dealing with things that make you messy can be exalted, inspiring, holy, spiritual. Quite right. Quite right. Depends on where you look. Do you look at the externals or the internals? So here, you're dealing with the developing human being. If you have a sensitivity to what a human being is, this should not be regarded as a terrible tragedy that you change diapers. So it all depends upon what your perspective is on what you're doing. Now here, I think this is absolutely crucial from our point of view. Producing the next generation of Jews who are going to live the Torah, receive the Torah, and be the guarantors for the Torah, is a task of enormous importance. To say that I don't find that fulfilling is to be out of touch with what the roles really mean. So because you don't have the male expression and you're focused on this side, certainly doesn't mean that you're losing out.
I wasn't really talking about motherhood, though, because there's also the period before motherhood and the period after, when you're sort of, once your kids have moved down the house, and before, all the way until...
Oh, you speak in great ignorance. The kids never move out of the house. They just go away temporarily in between when they come for Shabbos and they come for the weekend. There are grandchildren to care for and to worry about and to be concerned with and to invest in. It isn't like that really. But aside from that, there are extended families. Now, thinking of the nuclear family, one of my mechutn in English. Not my in-laws. Okay. People with whom our child and their child have married.
We call them
mechutn, yeah, whatever they are. Right? So when he makes a wedding, the first 200 places go to relatives. Because he has 14 children. And most of them are married with their own children. And then he has his own siblings and their children and the cousins. Right? We have a clan. Now, in a clan, there's usually somebody who needs help. A new birth, or God forbid, a sickness of some kind, or an injury of some kind, or an economic problem. So a person who thinks, when I help out any other person, and certainly any other Jew, and certainly any person in my family, I'm doing God's will. I'm playing the role in the world that He wants me to play. I'm building God's presence on earth. Such a person doesn't feel that they're lacking religious expression. Here's a problem, I think, especially the Baalei Tshuva. Baalei Tshuva need constant reinforcement for this new religious perspective. Now, usually they were reasonably kind and sensitive people before, so they don't naturally associate kindness and sensitivity as a religious expression. So in order to reinforce the psychology, they look for purely symbolic expressions. Expressions which wouldn't have been done in the prior stage of existence. Right? And there, because of the immaturity of their religious identity, they have a greater need for the symbolic, whereas a person who has a mature religious identity says, whether it's symbolic or not, if it's God's will, and I can say I'm doing this because you want it done in the world, then I feel that I'm expressing myself religiously, doesn't feel restricted in that way. Yeah?
Sorry, there was the first part to this question, before they have kids.
So that's what I was saying. There are cousins that need help. One of the children's having trouble in school, she can help tutor that child. This woman had a birth. You know, in Beitar, where two of my children live, when a woman gives birth, there's a local community, organization, that provides meals for 2 weeks. Because a woman who's just given birth and has other children in the house, things are tough. So they need help. So there are always people who need some kind of help. And if you say, Abraham ran out in the heat of the day to welcome people into his house because God wants that done. So if I go and help people and God wants that done, I feel I've had a strong religious day expressing myself the way the Torah wants the world to be developed. So how does that happen? But I didn't put on tefillin. So what? So what?
Yeah. So you're saying, helping extended family, let's say, not extended family, but is that any more the woman's mitzvah than the man's?
It is only more in the sense that she has less competing mitzvahs. It's a mitzvah for a man as well, but a man has more other competing mitzvahs. So, in practical terms, his time is going to be more divided. That's true. So, indeed, the major responsibility is going to fall on her, just as childbearing does. And I'll tell you something else. That same Rebbetzin in Baltimore made an astonishing observation. You look at a man's day. A man's day is planned out. It's planned out. And there's hierarchy of rules that apply. And when he isn't doing anything else, it's a mitzvah, he should be studying Torah. Very little. How is it very little? Relatively little is left open to his judgment. What shall I do now? How shall I do it? What shall my approach be? Comes to women who have children, where's the rule book? There are some pointers and some priorities. But basically, it's left to the woman's judgment and perception how to do it.
How is that different than the man?
Well, A man's day, in terms of his hours, in terms of the priorities, and in terms of the way in which he's supposed to perform, is laid out in very great detail. A woman... Well, he has to dive in three times a day in shul with a minyan, which restricts him. And working should be done only enough in order to support the family, although he can choose a profession, but beyond that. And then he's got to be studying. And what he should study, there's really a hierarchy of what he should study and how much he should study of with different subjects. Very little is left to his judgment. Whereas raising children, a woman has to exercise much more judgment, much more perception. Sounds like the Torah is giving a vote of confidence to a woman's judgment more so than it's giving a vote of confidence to a man's judgment. So if you're looking for challenge, which requires sensitivity and rethinking and networking with other people and analyzing and testing and analyzing results of the test and then trying another strategy, it's a very creative role, a more creative role than is given to the typical man. Yeah. That's it. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah.
There's a Revison in America, I don't recall her name, but she's a motivational speaker for Baal Shuv. She's toured across the country, and she does a lot of great work. I mean, she brings a lot of people back to Torah, but on the other hand, she's a very public figure, going back to the whole authority versus power thing. She's very public. She's out in the open. Do you kind of support this type of activity where Revison is so out there in a public figure, or do you think she should...
I don't want to comment on the individual, but in general, this can be done. For example, women typically run Beis Yaakov schools. A school may have 1,000 students or 2,000 students, and in a helot, the principal who takes the chief administrator of such a school is usually a woman. Now, you know what it means to administer a school. You know, it's a large undertaking with a lot of responsibility. And women speak in public to mixed audiences in our circles. It's a perfectly acceptable activity. At the Gudas Israel Convention, there are usually some women speakers. Women write for the publications, the national and international publications. So the ability of a woman to speak, to have her voice heard, to present her ideas in public is something which is definitely accepted. Now, the way in which it's done and the purposes for which it's done, of course, have to be monitored. But here's where we do allow, we feel that these things are more important than this issue is in that case. Sarah Schneerer, who invented the modern network of schools for women, she was in Poland in the 1920s. She came up with this idea, and she went around to certain of the leaders of the generation, and they agreed with her. And the Gera Rebbe at that time, we have the letter out, he wrote to his Hasidim in a certain city that his Hasidim should go and hear her speak. Now, she spoke from behind a curtain. But the men, with an audience of men, and she spoke to this audience of men, Hasidim. So when there's a genuine necessity, and of course bringing people back to Torah is definitely a genuine necessity, and if it's done in the best possible way, the serious issue is not going to stand in the way.
You said earlier that woman was created in order to so that man wouldn't feel like he was the ruler of the world. In other words,
So
an equal was needed to be made in order so that there was no superiority. But from the sounds of it, the fact that women are always correct in the crisis times, and we say that women are a higher spiritual level than men, and there are all these advantages that women have. It seems that they are superior to men.
Yeah.
So doesn't that complicate the problem?
It would if it were true. Now here you see, I must tell you, when I first came to Asamech 22 years ago, there was somebody else on staff who was teaching philosophy also at the time. And very quickly, I would say something and the students would say, "How can you say that?" He said the exact opposite. So the first few times I called him up and I said, "How could you say that?" And he said, "Say what? X, Y, Z." "I didn't say that." "You didn't? Well, the students told me you did." She said, "Oh. I said ABC, and they deduced PQR, and then they misunderstood PQR to mean STU, and then they deduced from STU, XYZ, with a mistaken deduction. And that's how they got to XYZ. But it had nothing to do with what he said." Now, this phrase, which you just said, which you hear in many people's mouths, that women are more spiritual than men. I didn't say it, and I didn't say anything to imply it. What I said was, there is a particular aspect that they have that men don't have. But your statement is a general statement. It's an overall sum up that they're more spiritual than men. I didn't say that, and nothing I said implied it. What I said was, they have this particular spiritual aspect that men don't have. The sum up, I think, would be impossible to make, because it's apples and oranges. They're not in the same dimension. You're not going to be able to sum it up and say, well, they got 16 points for this, 27 points for that, 47 points for that, add it up, and then, because they're not points in the same dimension. And therefore, it's important to know what aspects women have that men don't have, and vice versa, what aspects men have that women don't have, and then to try to work out a meld of the two. I also didn't say that he will think of himself as ruler. What I said is it shouldn't appear, and I left that open and vague, appear to whom? But you're right, that's more or less what I meant. But by the point, I didn't say appear to whom. Right? And the Rashi brings the Chazal, it's not really clear, at one point he thinks maybe it's the angels who will think of it. Anyway, just pointing out that there's more to that than we can just... Yeah?
You mentioned about this, it being more applicable to women, they have a greater degree of responsibility than men. So therefore, is there a different framework for men and women in terms of what their responsibilities are in socialism? How do we know this?
You mean in general? You're not now using this just as an example. You're asking now the general question?
Yeah.
Look, this goes back to a point that I made the other day, and I'll repeat it because it's very important. The only way we know any of this is that it comes from revelation. If it didn't come from revelation, we would be totally ignorant. None of this is intuition or theorizing or analysis or whatever. It's got to come from revelation, directly or indirectly, but it's got to be rooted in revelation. Otherwise, we couldn't know any of this. Now, the framework for the roles is the rules of the laws of Judaism and the values of Judaism. And those are all based on revelation. And the complex is really an additive complex. Just add up these rules and these values. It's not as if somewhere there's a stamp male and a stamp female and it's a general proposition from which everything else follows. No, it works from the ground up. I have all these laws and all these values and I summarize them by pulling them together. More than that we can't do. Yeah?
Well, you said, and I just want to clarify, a certain understanding from what you just read, that women are naturally geared to reach certain levels a lot easier than men.
Well, let's put it this way. A person's success in life is what he does for himself. What he's given, either given by his quality, inherent quality of soul, or he's given because his parents trained him in certain ways, none of that is any credit to him. So if you'll tell me that women are created in such a way that they naturally develop certain spiritual levels more easily, more quickly than men, that means that that's not their challenge. And that's not where the success lies, and that's not where the reward is going to lie. So then it becomes irrelevant. It isn't as if they may be more spiritual in the sense that they're naturally inclined in this direction, but that doesn't mean they're any better as people, they deserve any more credit or respect or reward for that. So it could be that if it were true, or in whatever dimensions it's true, a man could say, I'll look to a woman in this dimension, because she's likely to have a higher level of spirituality, I can learn something from it, and I can be inspired by it. But in terms of the value of their lives, it won't reflect at all. So it's very important to keep those two things distinct. Yeah.
Back home in Canada, when many of the women are working nowadays, and the roles seem to be getting less and less distinct in the house, actually what they're doing, and they're at home less hours, and what are the differences practically in Judaism that this sort of, the roles seem to be getting very, very similar?
Well, I don't know how similar it gets over there, but I can tell you, I have a son-in-law who makes sponge every Friday afternoon, that means mopping out the floors of the house, and he makes the children every week, and he puts the kids to bed one night or two nights a week. He helps out because his wife needs it, because and her, they have a lot of kids in a short amount of time, and he knows it has to be done, so he does it. If he didn't have to do it, he wouldn't have to do it. He does it in the same spirit as what he said, that the women who go to work do so as a voluntary effort to help the other side fulfill its responsibilities, because the other side can't do it under those conditions. So here also, the men will do this, take the children to the doctor and feed children and get up in the middle of the night with bottles, especially a newborn. So it will happen. Now, whether we get to the point where the roles are indistinguishable, look, it was so at a time. There was a time in history when if husband and wife were not working all day long just to make money, they would starve. There was no other alternative. You had a farm, both were working from day to night. The scholarly class was 1% of the population. 99% were working morning, noon, and night. And then the men and women were working, you know, shoulder to shoulder.
Is it no longer, though, that if it happens at that point, is it no longer that the women are sort of rearing up the whole home, as we were saying? Does it?
Well, there's a loss. There's definitely a loss.
There's a loss.
Of course there's a loss. Because that is her primary responsibility. Though you have to define responsibility in a tricky way now, because it's not legal, it's value, it's value-based. But it is a value-based responsibility. And if she's not doing that, then she definitely needs a reason not to do it.
And if, let's say it comes to the point where, in most families it's equal, that they're both doing the same amount for their children, and they're both working the same amount of hours, if it gets to that point, would these children be disadvantaged compared to a family where the wife would be staying home and the husband would not be raising the house so much, or would it not? Because then how do you really say that the woman has all this extra greatness in taking care of the family if the man could do it just with equal result?
Well, I think they would be disadvantaged. They'd be disadvantaged, at least in part, because of the fact that they were getting a non-standard role model. A non-standard model of the roles of men and women in the way the family should be structured, and that they're growing up with that non-standard model. But indeed, yes, we would say that the sensitivity and the natural orientation of women towards the way you deal with another human being's needs is something that's very important for the children, more so than what a man can give to a young child. Yes.
That's right.
Yeah.
I find many times that when someone is not obligated to do something, they shouldn't. Right? For like, for example, women aren't obligated to wear two feet, and therefore they shouldn't wear them.
There's no therefore. From not obligated, only follows not obligated. There has to be some other extra reason which says that they shouldn't do it. If there's no extra reason they shouldn't do it, then indeed they do do it. For example, lulav and esrog, which are not obligated to do, in our circles, every woman takes a lulav and esrog. Shofar, which are not obligated to do, every woman in our circles hears shofar on Rosh Hashanah. So the fact that something is not obligated is no reason whatsoever to refrain from doing it. You need some other extra reason to make it negative.
So a woman can wear tefillin?
No, I didn't say that. I gave the other example. Good that you asked.
Which are the ones that women can't do?
Okay, cannot. It's certainly preferable that they should not, and that is tefillin and tzitzis. Learning what we'll call theoretical Torah, we're going to talk about this next time. What else is there?
Sukkah
is
totally okay.
I have a list here.
Sukkah is totally okay. It's very highly recommended that a woman should really recite Shema, and she has to make Kiddush Friday night. That's not even out. There's no alternative. She must do that.
It don't seems to be things that they wear.
Huh?
It only seems to be things that you wear.
Well, yeah, it's also the learning of the theoretical Torah, which
festivals.
She can't. Huh?
Festivals?
She's responsible for everything.
So she really should not learn.
Okay, we'll talk about this when I talk about it in detail. Right? This is one of the subjects in the legal section, which I'll do. And if you're very impatient, you can look at Meiselman's book, which we have here in the library, and read a chapter on the study of Torah. Yeah.
If there are six, well, actually, I don't know. I haven't really checked this out myself, but in Nach, aren't all the Nevi'im, for the most part, men? If there were 600,000 men and 600,000 women, how come all the ones that are...
Are you asking all or for the most part?
I believe they're all men.
No, they're not. Certainly not all men. Devorah was a prophetess. Miriam was a prophetess. Huldah was a prophetess. There are a whole bunch of them. But it's like something like... It's very unbalanced. It's very unbalanced. The vast majority are men. But before we ask that question, let's ask, if there were 600,000 male prophets, how come only about 50 made it into the book? And forget about women. Suppose there were no women. You'd still have to answer that question. Right? So the answer is that a prophet need not have a message that's of relevance to future generations. Indeed, according to many, like Ramchal, a prophet doesn't have to have a message at all. Prophet just means a person's attached to God, attached very powerfully to God, and experiences God in a certain way. That's all. Doesn't have to be sent on a mission. Tell so-and-so to water his petunias. You don't have to do that. That's not part, essentially, of being a prophet. So the vast majority of prophets didn't tell anybody to do anything. They just achieved that august spiritual state and experienced God in that special way. Some were sent on missions that were local missions, and some were sent on missions and gave communications which are crucial for succeeding generations. The vast majority of that class were men. Yeah.
I read recently in a newspaper that Orthodox community where there's women that get together and have their own minion and govern. I was wondering what you think about that.
Okay, my husband discusses this. No, then I've got to quit. I'm going to use this as an opportunity to share with you a very important principle. Let me do the general, and then I'll come back to the particular issue. Here is an attitude which you find very widespread. I want to do X. Where does the Torah prohibit it? Show me where the Torah says no. Listen, I follow the rules. If the Torah says no, I'm not going to do it. Just show it to me. Prove it to me that it's wrong. So you go through all the rules, and you figure out, doesn't violate this, I'll do it this way, so it won't violate that. I get around this one this way, and then, guess what? Doesn't violate any rules. So, it's perfectly all right to do it. The whole logic is warped. The whole logic is warped. Chazanish called this principle, this point of view, the point of view of 613 problems. 613 obstacles. See, the mitzvahs are obstacles. They're getting in the way of what I want to do. Now, I recognize them. They're true. They're valid. They're genuine. So if I bang against an obstacle, I'm going home. But if I can only steer clear, if I can only avoid all the mitzvahs, then I'm home free and I can do as I please. What's the truth? The truth is that the mitzvahs are your opportunities to connect to God. If a person manages to steer clear of all the mitzvahs, then what he's saying is, I have found something to do that will not connect me to God at all. That's a great recommendation for doing it. That's a great justification for doing it. No, the attitude ought to be, which mitzvah am I fulfilling? Show me a mitzvah that says I should do this, and then I'll do it. But if you can't find me a mitzvah that I am fulfilling, then it's a gross waste of time. And frankly, you're responsible not to waste your time. So the whole attitude which starts, prove to me it's wrong, and if you can't prove it's wrong, then it's perfectly okay to do, it's an upside-down attitude. It's an attitude that does not express understanding of what it means to live in the world and to understand that you have to spend your time trying to attach to God. So, many of these minyanim are based on the idea we're going to do as much of what the men do as we can, and we'll just figure out a way that it can be done. Can be done means there's no obstacle to it. But ask, what are you accomplishing thereby? Where in our corpus do you find that this is a valuable activity? You ain't going to find it. That's number one.
It's easy to put the sounds on first.
Sorry?
usually do it for themselves, I think.
Correct. That means it's not violating.
Doing it for Hashem or doing
it for... So this is it. So then it comes out, then it comes out that the whole motivation is not, I'm doing it for God, because if the motivation were doing it for God, I would want to see where God tells me that he wants me to do it. So then the whole motivation is a different motivation. Here is exactly what he says in my last point. I have a friend who lives in Flatbush. He's a Rav and he's in a shul, someone from whom I've learned a great deal. And he said to me once, many years ago when I was just starting out, that a woman came to him, well, wife of one of the members of his shul, and asked him for permission to go and get a job. See, if you live the right way, you do that. You go to the rabbi and ask for permission to do something. Anyway, so the rabbi asked me, what do you think I told her? And I fell right into the trap. I said to him, well, Jewish women have worked from forever, you know. Nothing wrong with working, so he must have told her it was okay. He said, no, I told her it's forbidden. I said, what? Why did you do that? And he said, listen, the members of my congregation are well-to-do. She doesn't lack for anything. There's plenty of money. Why does she want a job? Because she doesn't feel fulfilled, successful, active, creative, and she doesn't have a job, an office, her name on the office, her own expense account. This is a totally false value. Look in the book of Jonah. This says everything, huh?
Even pictures.
Yeah, even pictures at the end, right? It's got nowhere to look for it. Where do they hide Jonah? Look at the table of contents. It's desperate. Okay. The question is, see, the ones that are used, that are read on the holidays, they sometimes don't put in. Let me have that. This has it because it's read on Yom Kippur. Now here they are on the ship, and there's a terrible storm, and the ship's going to go down, and the captain says, everybody pray to your gods, and Jonah's sleeping. Sleeping downstairs. No problem. And finally, they wake him up, and then they cast lots, and the lots fall out on Jonah, and they say to him, study the book of Jonah for the sailors. That's astonishing what kind of people these sailors are. But anyway, they say to him, tell us now in regard to whom has this calamity fallen us. Now question mark, but period. Mispunctuated. Tell us now, you're the cause of the calamity. Tell us. What is your trade? First question. Where do you come from? What is your land? What people are you? That's as modern as today. If you have one question to ask somebody you just met, what are you asking? What are you doing? You don't mean how do you spend your weekend. What you mean is what is your job? Because, in modern terms, and it seems in then as well, if I know one thing about you, your job, I'll know more about you than any other single piece of information. It'll tell me about your education, it'll tell me about your social class, it'll tell me about the kinds of activities you invest in. Right? So this is what they ask. Job, origin, land, and people. He said to them, I am an Ivri, and Hashem, the God of the heavens, who I fear, who made the sea and the dry land. He doesn't even answer the question of job. His answer is, you're asking a Jew what his job is? You're not going to learn much about a Jew from his job. Abraham was a shepherd. Shepherds were the lowest of ancient economies, a totally unskilled profession. Take them out in the morning, bring them back in, and they eat all by themselves. You don't have to feed them. They just eat the grass, right? He said, who's Abraham? Oh, he's a shepherd. What do you know about Abraham now? Rabbi Yochanan was a shoemaker. Hillel, for a time, was a woodchopper. Rabbi Eliezer was a business tycoon. He had ships on all the seas. Did that tell you who Rabbi Eliezer was? A person who defines his identity by his job has a wrong identity. An impoverished, spiritually barren identity. So, this friend of mine says, this woman who's telling me that she doesn't feel she has a fulfilled identity without a job, she's throwing herself into the garbage can. So I said to him, well, what about all the men who feel that way? He said, you're right, but a man has an obligation, as he said before. A man has an obligation to support his family. So he's thrown into that pit, and he has to struggle with that temptation not to have his identity taken over by his job. Correct. But he's got to do that. She doesn't have to do it. So what we have to find is for her to a way to better perceive and value her Jewish identity and focus on expressing that. And this is really the crucial point. So these women, one of the great rabbis of the 20th century, a woman came to him and said, I want to wear a talis. I see that for the men, it helps them focus and helps them concentrate and it inspires them. I want to wear a talis. So he said to her, look, let's try it out. But let's try it out in stages. Buy the garment, the rectangular garment. Don't put the strings in. And try it out for a while, and we'll see what effect it has. So she bought it, and she tried it out, came back sometime later, and said to her, how did it go? Oh, terrific. It's terrific. Just what I thought, you know. I really feel more spiritual and focused and concentrated. She said to her, oh, so it's working. So keep it like that. Keep it like that. You don't need the strings. That means, what is she after? She's not after the mitzvah. She's not doing any mitzvah. She's after the symbol because that's what the men do. Is she doing this for God? God doesn't come into the picture. Like the women of every shavuos want to go and daven by the kosel. They don't come on a deserted Monday night. They come once a year on shavuos because the press is there. That has nothing to do with religion. It has to do with making a statement for equal rights. Yeah.
I just have a little question about that. The story that you were just saying with the tis, because don't, I mean, the rest also has a significance, like covering your head. If the tells they make a difference, it'll make any difference if you cover your head or not, but they say that if you cover your head, you have more Yirat Shamayim or something. So doesn't it make a difference even the...
First of all, she could wear a hat. And if she's married, she ought to be wearing a hat. In this case, her head's covered anyway. And if she wants to cover her head, you know, it has nothing to do with the talis. You have to buy a talis to cover your head. There are millions of female head coverings that people wear. And a man whose head is covered anyway does wear a talis, in the morning anyway. He found his mincha mire without it somehow. You can't imagine how he manages that. But in Shabbos, so it's more complicated than that. Okay.
This one is...